You're listening to First Words, a podcast where creativity, career, and kids collide. We're your hosts, Jasmine Aluma.
And I'm Casey Gates Fry. Our guest today, Anna Breton, is a Latina director and producer who is a very funny lady. She currently works as a producer on The Kelly Clarkson Show on NBC. She also worked as a digital producer at The Drew Barrymore Show and Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, where she was nominated for 2 Emmy Awards.
Anna has directed and produced video content for IFC, CISO, GQ, UCB Comedy, and Brava, a video platform focusing on the Latina experience. Follow her on Twitter, at Miss Breton, for her hilarious and often viral commentary on politics, pop culture, and becoming a mother in a global pandemic. Her daughter is now 2 years old.
My first question is that you have a wide range of skills in the arts and you wear many different hats. And so I would just love for you to first talk us through the different kinds of jobs you've had in the creative field and where do you find your creativity flourishes best?
Wow. That is a broad question. I've done writing in several different aspects of my career. I started as a journalist after college. I actually covered crime for a while. Before true crime was hot, I was a crime journalist, going to court, going to prisons, interviewing people. And then I decided that was too sad. So I switched over to the documentary field because I already had an interest in movies and making films. So I did a lot of unscripted work before I really stopped and decided to pursue comedy. So my husband and I did the thing where we moved to New York and signed up for the Upright Citizens Brigade and began just writing and producing and directing comedic content. He's also a comedic writer. So we have collaborated on a few things. And I think lately most of my writing has been in the unscripted space, which a lot of people don't know that has a lot of writing involved. In a documentary, you don't go into writing things. So you will interview people, you will basically film for a long time, and then you come back and start crafting and writing the story. And that's really what I'm into. I like writing nonfiction stuff, and I like writing funny stuff. What I really like to do is turning unscripted nonfiction stuff into funny things. And on the side, I also write for Bus Magazine, which I've been a fan of since I was a teenager and recently got the opportunity to write for them. And so now I have an article pretty much in every issue, and it's been one of the greatest things ever because I get to write feminist things, which I also love. So I'm really getting to do a lot of things that I like right now, which is great. These are my top favorite tweets. Follow me on Twitter, at Miss Breton, B-R-E-T-O-N. You can tell my baby is a pandemic baby because her best friend is a lid. Guys, how did we used to do so much pre-pandemic? We used to get ready, go to work, go to the gym, see friends, make dinner, all in one day. Today, I did the dishes, and I am tired. I'm not gonna say who, but a friend invited me to his birthday party that starts at 9 p.m., my current bedtime, and then 100 exclamation points. I'm gonna start making Mexican NFTs. N nachos, F flan, T tacos. Professional question, do I disclose after a job interview, during, or before about how much I cry? I miss going to parties, getting immediately overwhelmed, and just hanging out in the bathroom for the rest of the time. These are all based on true stories.
You grew up in Mexico City and didn't move to the U.S. until you were 9. What was the catalyst for your family's decision to move, and where in the States did you first end up?
So I was born in Mexico City, Mexico, biggest city in the world. Somebody fact check that because it might have changed. And as you said, I moved to the U.S. with my family when I was 9. And that was a lot of my parents wanting for us to be safe. Mexico City was getting really dangerous. A few of my family members had really bad experiences there in the city where they were getting robbed. They just had very traumatic things happen to them. And I think it was why ultimately my parents were like, we have to go, we have to, you know, protect our kids. So they moved to Utah out of all places.
I keep asking them, like, why Utah of all places? Very different than Mexico City. And I think they had just heard that it was a really safe place to have kids grow up in. So they just kind of went for it. They were like, we're going to move. We're going to take everything. And they really left their careers and their friends and, you know, wanted a better life for us. So I'm very thankful that they did that. But it was a huge risk on their part. And that's how we ended up in Utah out of all places.
It's very pretty.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's a very beautiful place.
Yeah.
But I always had craved living in a city. So that's why I moved to New York. My parents they accepted it later on, but they were like, we just moved you to a safe spot. Why do you want to move to New York? Mm-hmm. But anyways.
So you volunteered at the Mexico-U.S. border during the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico program, which you wrote about for Bust magazine. While helping at a respite center, you connected with a young mother who was 9 months pregnant. Where were you in your own pregnancy timeline at that moment?
That is a very good story and I really haven't told a lot of people. But yes, I went with a bunch of my friends from New York to volunteer at the border because I had produced a bunch of field pieces there. And I had met people at a respite center in McAllen, Texas, and saw there was a need for volunteers. So I just said, hey, who wants to go? And gathered about 20 people. And we just went and basically helped. And it was the people who were coming out of, as they call them, the refrigerators, the horrible places you saw back in 2016 that are still around, where people were deprived of all their belongings. And once they got out, the respite center kind of took them in and gave them food, clothes, shoes, and helped them get on their way. So that's what we helped do. So I did meet a young mother who was 9 months pregnant, and she had crossed the border with her son. And during the trip, all of us got very sick. So we got the neurovirus, which was going around the respite center because you're dealing with people who have just crossed multiple countries. And so, you know, there's a lot of bacteria going around. I'm not saying, you know, anything bad at all about these people, but you're just dealing with people who have crossed the desert. So all of our group got sick. We got the neurovirus, including myself. So it was like a day or two of just throwing up, and it took us out. But we all recovered. We were able to continue volunteering. And once the volunteer trip was over, I actually met up with my husband in Colorado. He was giving a speech to he's a writer, so he was giving a big speech to Toastmasters magazine. And during that trip, I was feeling sick, and I was kind of just like, I think it's still from the neurovirus. I think it was from the stress of the trip and planning the trip. And he was like, why don't you just take a pregnancy test? And I was like, oh, yeah, fine. And so I did. And then to our shock, we found out we were pregnant. We had planned for a kid. We just didn't know I was going to be there. So the whole time during the trip, I had been pregnant and didn't know. So I looked back at all the photos from being at the border and being like, oh, well, my daughter was there with me a little bit.
The article really touched me. And so, and I like can't help but I think once you become a mother, you just like are always looking at the world through the lens of being a mother. I think it's just like you can't stop. And so in reading your article, I think I had this kind of mama to mama reaction to, like, I think that would be really hard for me to be in a place to watch other mothers struggle like that. So I was just so curious about where you were in there. And even though you didn't know that you were pregnant at the time, like, I'm sure that hit you on some level.
I mean, just seeing the kids, the small, small kids who had, you know, crossed the border and were seeking asylum, which, by the way, was completely legal. And they were just looking for a better life. And they were so small and they had nothing. And their parents had just sacrificed everything. So I think, I don't know, I really felt for them as a former immigrant. And I don't know, just like seeing these little kids just like running around, being super happy, not knowing what was going on. And seeing how much their parents were willing to give up for them, it was really touching. It was, yeah. So that's kind of why I did the trip in the first place. I'm like, we got to help. Like, if we can help, we should help. Yeah. And I'm glad that a lot of my friends felt the same way. So I've been wanting to go back. I was going to go back the next year, but then obviously I had a baby. Mm-hmm. But I've been wanting to go back and do it again.
Yeah.
So this is from the article about volunteering at the border and the woman I met at the respite center. One day between food service shifts, I notice a woman sitting on a row of plastic chairs. She has a youthful face, wavy brown hair, and a baby who alternates between vomiting on the floor and bouncing in her lap. I notice how happy he is between puke sessions. I grab cleaning supplies and wipe up the floor around her, introducing myself as a volunteer. The baby is 1 year old and has been throwing up since Mexico, she says. He's unbothered and continues to smile. I make it a point to check in on her, each chat we have unraveling a new piece of her life. She's from Honduras. It took her 2 months to reach the United States, alternated between walking, taking buses, and hitchhiking. I ask her where she stayed along the way, expecting to hear about cheap hotels and couches, being extremely naive to the situation. She says she slept in abandoned houses, alleyways, anywhere she could, all with her one-year-old baby. She tracks her journey by important, often tragic milestones. Her phone was stolen in a town in Mexico. Her last bit of money ran out in another Mexican town. When she got close to the border, a group of men tried to kidnap her and her baby in a blacked-out van. Luckily, two other men who saw what was going on helped her get away. She says she considered seeking asylum in Mexico, but the day she tried to apply for it, a group approached her and tried to buy her baby. I watched the same baby continue to bounce on her lap, smiling from ear to ear. They said they could offer good money for both children. Both, I ask. She holds up her baby higher, revealing her belly. She's 9 months pregnant. She says this was not the only time she almost got separated from her children. They were crossing the Rio Grande River, she explains, the last big hurdle in their journey. She swam across at 9 months pregnant. At the deepest point, the river can reach 60 feet, with her baby in her arms. But when she was about to touch American soil for the first time, her foot got wedged in a tree root deep beneath the water. She couldn't move. She knew she had to make a choice. I try to keep a calm face as she continues to explain. Engulfed in dirty water and trapped, she used all her strength to throw her baby boy to the other side. She says he somehow held onto a fence. Even she can't explain how. Once she saw him securely reach the other side, she tells me she resigned herself to the fact that she was about to die. Many asylum seekers have died trying to cross the Rio Grande. A photo of a father and his daughter killed while trying to cross the Rio Grande made the cover of the New York Times this past June. Her son was safe, and that's all that matters, she says. With her foot stuck below, she knew that this is where her journey would end after 1,600 miles. But out of nowhere, a man jumped into the river and pulled her as hard as he could. She had bruises on her arms, but she was free. She doesn't know if this was a Border Patrol agent, a U.S. citizen, or a Mexican. It didn't matter. For a few minutes, wet and frayed, she held her son tightly on the edge of the Rio Grande. Not long after that, she was picked up by Border Patrol and sent to a detention center. I'm just blessed to be here, she says.
Are you still in touch with her? I know you connected via Facebook with Carla.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Carla's a pseudonym I gave her in the article because I wanted to protect her privacy, but we're absolutely in touch. We are on WhatsApp and I'm checking in with her kids. She posts on Facebook all the time. And I send her Christmas presents with her for her kids every year. I'm like, what do they need? Let me send you like a gift box of whatever you guys need. Like sometimes it's just like socks and cups, literally. But I'm still in touch with her. She recently just got married, actually, which I'm so excited about. And so when I met her, she had her two-year-old boy and she was pregnant. So she has her two boys and her daughter was actually able to cross the border and be with them. So she joined the family. She still has one more daughter who we're kind of like waiting for. And every once in a while, she'll be like, how do I do this? Like, what's going on in the news? How bad is it? What should I do? And I've been able to connect her with some lawyer friends that I made. So hoping to get her daughter over here.
So your daughter, Elena, is now two. And after she was born, you experienced postpartum depression. And yeah, I was just curious how that impacted your writing specifically.
Woo! Yeah, I mean, it impacted everything in my life. It was extremely traumatic. I don't think I was able to write for a while. And then you know, once I got through therapy and being duly lovely medicated, I was able to sort of explore my feelings about it. And there was a moment in time where I was so frustrated and I wanted to express what I was going through. And I just sat down and wrote a pilot. And it came out in 3 days. It was literally like this, these are things I'm feeling and these are characters that I want, you know, to tell the story about. And I just sat down and I wrote it in 3 days and it all came out. And I'm not saying the draft is perfect. I've since gone back and, you know, rewritten it. But it's definitely about being a new mom and just things that aren't talked about and things they don't tell you when you have kids. So I wanted to get that out there. And my hope is that in the future it'll be made into a show so it can help other new moms explore their feelings. Yeah, it's a whole new world. When I was going through postpartum, I couldn't do anything. I couldn't like write. It wasn't a good time. I had to, you know, it was months and months after I was like, okay, it is time to talk about what's going on.
So your daughter Elena was born May 2020, a few months into the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And you shared with us that for the first 2 years of her life, you basically, you and your husband both worked and raised her and did not get childcare support for 2 years. So I just would love to hear, what was that division of labor like? How did you do it? I think even though we don't have the same COVID restrictions at the time, there's still a lot I think that parents are dealing with and deciding how to manage that. So I would just love to hear your experience.
So I'll go back a little bit. I was 7 months pregnant when COVID happened, March 2020. And the first thing that I remember happening was I had planned my baby shower for March 2020, had to cancel it right away. And I was like, this won't be so bad. And then my husband and I made the choice to leave New York because our doctor's appointments were getting canceled. There was a Navy boat that was coming into the harbor to take extra COVID patients. And I don't think this would have happened, but in my mind, I'm like, I don't want to give birth on a boat. Like, that was like,
oh gosh.
Like, I don't think it would have happened, but I was like, I don't want that to be the thing that happens. So we made the choice to leave New York when I was, I think at the time I was 8 months pregnant. Too late to fly, but I got on a plane and we went back to Utah to live with my parents. So, and it was a thing of like, we're only going to be here for 3 months, then we'll go right back to New York and live our lives. But we ended up being there for 11 months. And my job had extended my maternity leave for 5 months, which was a godsend. It was the greatest thing. It was full frontal with Samantha Bee had done the most feminist thing and extended their maternity leave. And I'm so, so lucky they did that. So once it was over, I did have the support of my parents when we were living with them. But we were both working from home, my husband and I. And it was just a matter of like, every morning we're like, what time's your Zoom meeting? Here's when we're going to pass the baby back and forth. And she kind of became a football. And like for 2 years, we passed her back and forth. And when we did move back to New York, childcare, daycares were still shut down. And we just kept hearing horror stories about how, you know, kids would go in for a couple days and they would be shut down. And so we were just like, you know what? We've been doing this for a little bit, so we'll see how far we can get to it. And again, we passed the baby football for for way more time. And it was extremely hard. That's all I can say. I don't think I could have done it without my amazing supportive husband. And we both lost a lot of sleep. We both worked really hard because we both wanted to. And in the last 3 weeks have been the first 3 weeks with daycare, and it has been amazing. It has been such a change to be able to drop off our kid. And she loves it because she has not been around kids that much. So her being around other toddlers and learning has been incredible for her. Aww. And for us has been amazing.
Yeah.
Just having a couple hours of just working and sitting there.
Yeah.
Incredible. At my age, my parents had two kids and moved their entire lives to the U.S. for the American dream. And me, I stayed up until 3 a.m. to buy the 12-foot skeleton from Home Depot. So I guess it paid off, parents! Tomorrow at 3:30 p.m. Eastern, I will release a definitive ranking of all my friends named Jessica. Please stop making New Year's resolutions and start making blood oaths. Probably my favorite one. This is my pinned tweet. When I die, please preserve me in a bottle of mezcal like a worm. And I mean that.
So we talk a lot on this podcast about work-life balance, and everyone has a different relationship to that, different strategy. There's no one right way to do it. But I think that part of us wanting to create this podcast was listeners getting lots of different examples of what that means for each writer parent. And my question for you is, I would love to know, how do you decide to spend your time between motherhood, consistent salary or consistent paid jobs, and then taking more creative risks, more things that might require speculative work that aren't guaranteed income or might put you out there in a way that you're not sure how it's going to be received? So I would just love to hear like kind of your balance with all of that.
How do women do it all? Here's the thing, we do not. I am very tired all the time. Yeah, no, it has changed quite a bit. Before kid, I was traveling all the time for work. I was a field producer. I worked on a show where I was traveling 2 months at a time. So I would say, goodbye, husband, I'll see you in 2 months. And then I was off working. And then I would come back for a little bit, leave for 2 months. And I did that for a couple of years. And I absolutely love traveling and filming. One of my favorite things ever. But now I feel like I've seen the job postings for field producers, and I'm like, I can't leave my daughter right now. And that's okay, because I love spending time with her. But I know sometime in the future it'll happen again. Also, COVID helps not, you know, not to want to make me travel. But I just feel so lucky right now because I got a job at the Kelly Clarkson show. I'm producing for them. We're staying at home. We are working from home, which is great. So I get to spend time with her. I get to do the thing I love. For me, you know, not working was not an option. I did not want to be a stay-at-home mom. So we just made it work. But it has kind of come at a price of not being able to be a field producer and travel like I used to do before, but that's okay. I am really extremely loving being with her at home. I'm also on the side. I created these digital teams with Gold Comedy. That's kind of like a startup comedy group for women and non-binary folks. And I really wanted to do it. So it's kind of a part-time job right now where I advise women on how to produce comedy. And I very much have limited, and I have the luxury to limit the things I want to work on. So I know I like working on the Kelly Clarkson show. I know I like advising these digital teams, and that's kind of it. Anything else, I'll maybe not take something. I actually just said no to something on a weekend because they wanted to film for 2 days in a row. And I was like, I can't spend that much time away from my daughter. So I also want to respect my husband's time too, since he would be the one watching her. So And I was like, you know what? I'll chill with my kid and watch Tom Gabby's Playhouse.
Shout out.
Yeah, shout out. Sponsor me, please.
You mentioned your parenting style is naturally different than your mother's because you're parenting in a different time, in a different culture. But have you noticed any crossover? And how has your mother's experience parenting impacted your own?
I feel like I'm in therapy right now. Should I lie down? No, this is something that is extremely present all the time. First of all, I love the way I grew up. My mom was an incredible mom and dad. Amazing parents. Couldn't truly have done it without them. But they parented in the most dangerous city in the world, in a different culture, in a very strict environment. I think the thing that's like sticks in the top of my mind of like how truly dangerous it was. So at night, my mom would lock every door, make sure every window was down. And when I moved to America, like people left their front door open and like very casual cars were open. And like, again, this was like 96. So it was like, now it's not as free, but it was very like loose and people would let their kids sleep over at each other's houses. And you know, kids would play around on the street and my mom was like, you're not doing sleepovers. You're not doing that. Like anything could happen. So there was that like cloud of worry coming from that environment. So as I have my own kid, I do realize the difference. Like I still check all the locks at night and the doors and the windows, but I want her to be a little bit more free. So I like let her explore, let her do things a little bit more. But at the same time, of course, there were great things that my parents instilled in me, like a work ethic and working very hard. So those are the things that I want to pass on to my daughter. When we moved here, my dad worked four jobs, which is crazy. So I know the value of working very hard, and I want to pass that on to them, to her. I keep saying multiple kids. I only have one kid, for the record. But yeah, it's really weird growing up in two different cultures and like being able to decide like what do I want to give and take from that to my own daughter. And obviously my husband has a huge, you know, he's passing on the things he wants to. So very much more relaxed than my family, I would say, which is great. Great for us. Yeah.
So I'm just curious, if someone were to approach you knowing you have a 2-year-old daughter, knowing that you're continuing to work, and asked you for advice, if they were planning a family or wanted to have a child or asked, what would you tell them? And I know that like the advice thing is so, I don't know, it can feel so fraught because like, what is advice and how do we figure that out? But like, I would just be curious if someone did approach you, what you would say to them.
I recently went to my friend's baby shower. She is 8 months pregnant. And she asked me, she said, what advice do you have for me? Because I think I was the only person there with a kid. And I felt extremely bad because after having a kid and going through postpartum depression, I want to keep it real. Like, I want to warn these ladies what is going to happen. Yeah. So I just told her, I'm like, you're going to be really tired. All these things are going to happen. You might have really sad times. You might have postpartum depression. Like, hit me up. And I think I overwhelmed her in the moment because the baby shower was like, you know, they were like doing that thing where they're melting chocolate into a diaper. And like, was very light. And I was just like, listen, girl, it might get bad, but it's going to be okay. And she was, afterwards, I sent her a long text and I'm like, you're going to be a great mom. It's going to be fine. But I kind of wish someone had told me all this stuff. Yeah. Like, sleep deprivation is real and it's going to affect your life and your relationship with your partner is going to change and it's okay. But I just decided to keep it real with my friends. So I think if people came up to me and said, you know, what advice you have, I'm going to be the downer. So I'm so sorry in advance if you come up to me for that.
But yeah, that's interesting that no one prepared you for that, which I can get. I feel like when I have people that ask me or are talking about, oh, well, what was your birth experience like or something, like and they're pregnant, I'm like, I really try to draw the line between being real and not overwhelming. But I think, I don't know, something that helped me was a friend who was like 6 months ahead of me. She kind of was like, she kind of like vaguely told me how hard it would be and was like, I'm gonna be here. And we'll talk about it when you're there. Like, you know? And yeah. So she was like, she didn't tell me too specifically, like, because everyone's experience too is really different. But then that conversation I got to have with her, who she was very fresh too, postpartum. And, you know, I was just like, wait, but all of this is happening. And she's like, I know. I didn't want to tell you, but now we can talk about it. Like, I don't know. I think that that can be helpful too.
Yeah, I think one good thing that my mom suggested, she noticed that I was doing things kind of apart from each other. So like I would feel like I would have to be done cooking and then take care of my kid. And she's like, why don't you just include her in things? Like she likes to watch you cut up vegetables, like just have her watch you. And we tried it and my kid was mesmerized. So I'm learning to include her in the things that I'm doing instead of like, I'm going to get this done and then I'm going to take care of my kid. Like just including her. So I'm really looking forward to, you know, when I'm working on a set and like bringing her on there and having her watch what I'm doing. So that was a really cool thing that my mom was like, just make her part of it.
That's gold. That is gold. Yeah. I still struggle with that. Mm-hmm. And my husband's really good at it. And they like, Layla will come and ask like, can I help? And I'll be like, actually dinner's done. Yeah. And he's like, but is there something she could do? And I have to like stop myself in the moment and be like, yes, like you can stir this rice one more time. And it's like, it's just that. And then all of a sudden, like it just changes.
Yeah. They're interested in what you're doing. Yeah. And I feel like independent women are like, I have to get this done and then do the thing. Totally. You're like, you can just do it at the same time. Yeah. Like, make them.
I'm a separator too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, somebody take the child because I have to do this thing.
My husband put a picture on Instagram of me typing on my laptop and my kid was on my shoulders. And like, that was very real of like, yeah, including her. My husband, yeah, was like, you can just, she can watch you. She, mm-hmm, likes the sounds of the keyboard. And I was like, all right. All right. This is very topical. I'm thinking of pitching a show to Netflix called Inventing Anna, about me, Anna, inventing things like nighttime nachos, pillows for dogs, and anytime purrs cheese. My favorite time of the day is switching from my work laptop to my Netflix and online shopping laptop. I'm laughing at my own tweets. This is so dumb. Okay, oh, this is based on a true story. If you need me, I'm doing that mom thing where you go into a room, turn off all the lights, and just lay there staring at nothing. Ask your mom. She knows what I'm talking about. Today, oh my God, these are real thoughts I've had. Today I had the brilliant thought of, man, wouldn't it be fun if Starbucks sold margaritas, and then just immediately realized that it's just a bar. That's so stupid.
Okay, so now we're going to do rapid fire.
Love it. I'm ready. I had cold brew.
What were your daughter's first words?
She said Baba, which is dad in Greek, which my husband is Greek. I'm not jealous, but that's the truth.
It probably rolled off the tongue really easily.
For sure. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah. What was the first thing you said when you saw your daughter?
I kept saying, oh my God, over and over again. I'm sure you guys experienced this, but all the hormones rush into your body and it's the most incredible feeling. And they placed her on my chest and I just kept saying, oh my God, oh my God. There was nothing else.
What are the first words of your current project?
This is the scene that I'm most excited about. The pilot I wrote called Killer Moms. Exterior smoothie shop soon after. Becca and Michelle are sitting outside a smoothie shop. Becca is breastfeeding Olivia. Also with them is Janie, a petite 31-year-old mom with curly strawberry blonde hair. Becca has one hand on her forehead. She's just, I can't read suddenly. Becca has one hand on her forehead. She's just been told bad news. Becca, so let me get this straight. You all know this. Michelle and Janie. Mm-hmm. Becca, does everybody know this? Michelle, well, only moms know this. You start to realize it when you become one. Becca, so there's another version of you out there in the world just living her own life? Michelle, yep, it's the version of you that exists if you didn't have kids. That's what the pilot's,
ooh,
about.
There is that sensation of like every time something comes along that you want to do that like your other you would have done, mm-hmm, but the you that is living this life can't do it or has to like do all these extra things to navigate around it if they really want to do it. But it does feel like that person is very real and there's like this disconnect, this mourning, this loss, or not like being connected to that person.
I'm so glad you got, like, that's exactly, yeah, what I was, yeah, writing about how real that person feels. So yes. I just made it into a character.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
So this is the one that you wrote super fast.
Three days.
In 3 days.
I was like,
oh my God. It's just like divine inspiration, I'm sure. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. I'll tell you the spoiler of the whole thing, but so this woman discovers that her other self is out there living her life without kids, just having a great life. And the woman with the mom discovers that the only way to get rid of her past life is to kill her. So it's a comedy.
Oh my God.
It's a comedy.
Yeah.
I love it.
Also, if anybody's listening who wants to buy a pilot, let me know.
Yeah.
Hit me up.
Yeah, here it is.
Okay, so this is word association.
Okay.
So I say a word, and you tell me the first word that comes to mind. Oh my God, okay. When I say it. Funny.
Women.
Generational.
I mean, trauma. Sad.
Community.
Oh, families.
Support.
I mean, my first thought was bras. So.
That works. Loss.
Oh, no. We just celebrated the anniversary of my mother-in-law passing away. So that's been fresh on my mind for sure.
Red.
My favorite color.
Change.
I mean, becoming a mom. On theme.
Nice. I love like when I said support, you immediately said, well, the first thought was, and I'm like, wait, have you already had other thoughts?
It
was like a half second pause, and you're like, well, in retrospect, my first thought was.
I think it went bras, friends, yeah, family. And I'm like, okay, first one was bras, so I'll go with that.
You've been listening to First Words. You can find out more info on this episode's guest and the show on our website, firstwordspodcast.com. If this show resonated with you, please share it with other writer parents in your life. We're in this together. First Words is recorded, edited, and co-produced by James Hilmer.